Welcome. I'm happy to bring you yet another episode full of fresh Trench Crusade lore. Today, I'll be reading you a plethora of new lore that's been released by the talented team behind this game. On behalf of all of us, thank you to all the writers and artists that inspire us with their world building. This is the fifth entry into the series. If you are new to Trench Crusade, I suggest that you go through them in order. However, each episode stands on its own and adds to the scope of the Trench Crusade universe. All relevant links are below. Now, without any further ado, let's get started. To the uninitiated, the black arts of Gotic magic are a thing of mystery, of bargains, pleas, contracts and rituals, where heretic priests, warlocks and thaumaturges appeal to their dark patrons to wield supernatural powers. Gotic spells can grant immense power to interfere with God's creation, an act of rebellion to match the divine powers on earth. Some schools of thought say it is the acts of torture, sacrifice and torment which gives the magic its power, and certain demon philosophers of the second circle point to the tyrant God granting Satan permission to torment Job. The more nihilistic and fatalist schools of thought say there is no rebellion and believe they are simply following God's plan laid out at the very beginning of creation. They have no say in the matter. It is their nature to persecute humanity and to eventually topple Yahweh as the world he created becomes ever more sullied and tainted. In the strictest sense, Gotic magic is not directly usable by mere mortals. While the sorcerers and other fell creatures of the court are capable of tapping directly into the swell of Gotic power, thanks to their supernatural origins, human heretics can only act as conduits of the power infernal. Instead, the heretic priests beseech their patron demons for supernatural intervention. In return, the lords of hell then demand their followers to kill for them, both on the battlefield and by dragging innocents to the desecrated altars erected in their name. One of the most insidious gifts the demon lords bestow upon their dark ministry is unnaturally long life. It is the most fervent wish of most heretic users of Gotic magic to extend their lifespans so they can enjoy the fruits of luxury for longer than any faithful noble or rich merchant ever could. Addicted to the power and opulence of their status, they become ever more desperate to halt the march of time. Such heretic priests find that the rejuvenation they are granted wanes faster after each new sacrifice, driving them to commit ever worsening atrocities in their quest to postpone death. In return for these diminishing extensions of their life, their patron will demand them to take greater risks to achieve their aims. The end is always the same. The devil will have his due, and the souls of their servants go to their fiery doom, replaced by new, even more ambitious supplicants. Thus, many heretic warbands travel with an altar dedicated to their fell patrons. Of all the myriad obsidian tables, sacrificial stones, totems, and graven images, it is the blasphemous idols of the golden calf that are the best known and most dreaded by the faithful. During major invasions, entire processions of war altars come forth with the heretic armies. The largest ones are towering statues, their fires tended by scores of heretic priests wielding knives and staffs. They are often mounted on tracked vehicles, standing on high daises so they can be brought to the front. There, the heretic priests can tap into the aura they emanate when victims are tossed into the fire within. These idols represent slaughter on an industrial scale, for many of the greatest of heretic weapons require the reality-warping corruption of Gotic magic to function. The dreaded heretic artillery uses shells encased in Gotic runes, which cause madness as well as physical destruction. Without the black touch of the winds of Gotic magic, the sentient barbed wire would simply fall into an inanimate state. Competition for the most extravagant and gaudy idols is fierce between their demon lords, and none more so than the rivalry between the serpent heads of the court, reflecting the poisonous politicking of hell itself. Many lordly demons use the altars of the golden calf as a conduit between themselves and their followers. Mammon claims them solely for himself as a symbol of his wealth and rapacity, but it is Moloch, the current serpent head of envy, that is the most keen of all the infernal nobles in urging his followers to bring ever more victims to die in the fires built beneath the golden calf. The roots of Moloch's envy run deep into the time before time. As a lordly seraphim, he yearned to create followers of his own, but this was the one thing he could never have. And when he learned that even the lowliest of humans were given the gift of life and a promise of creation, a boon denied to Moloch despite his exalted status, his jealousy turned into envy that slowly consumed and corrupted him. Aeons have passed since the first rebellion, yet nothing has changed. Despite his adoring throngs of worshippers, Moloch lacks the thing he craves the most, the power of creation. Missing the true ability to create life, Moloch's envy for creation knows no bounds. In his bitterness, he covets child sacrifices above all, as it denies these beloved fruits of creation from the followers of his hated father. Heretics in Moloch's service know that capturing entire families will reap them the greatest rewards when they bring the captives to the golden, belching smoke and radiating, withering heat. It is Moloch's will that the parents see their offspring perish, their anguish being the only thing able to temporarily soothe the envy that gnaws at him day and night. Thus, Moloch is known as the devil that bathes in the blood of children and the tears of their mothers, to quell the envy that gnaws at his very being in his palace in the sixth circle of hell. He is lost in the labyrinth of his own jealousy and ego. To compensate, it is Moloch who creates the largest number of servants of the court, yoke fiends, and sorcerers and hell knights using blackened shards of broken fallen angels to give them a semblance of life. But in his black heart, he knows they are but counterfeits, creatures that can only multiply by diminishing themselves, the charred remains of their divine origin weakening with every new generation. So Moloch's envy burns ever brighter, matching the sacrificial fires on the altars of the golden calf. The beast has always been there. Kingdoms rise and topple, but the beast remains. It was there before man came to the wild places, and it is said that it will be there long after they are gone. In the ages when men prostrated themselves before graven images, they trembled before the beast. From the goat-headed Fomorians of Era and werewolves of Livonia to Rakshasa of India, the darkest tales of mankind tell of half-beasts with an unnatural craving for human flesh. But time ebbed and flowed, and the servants of the beast retreated before the march of civilization. As the world embraced the words of the prophets and the light of salvation, writing laws in tablets of stone and holy books, the path of the beast lay hidden in the trackless wilds of the world. The path was kept alive in the memory of those ancient ways and in the revelations that had prophesied the return of the beast from both land and the sea. Long did the memory of the dark cult lie dormant at the edge of nightmares, slumbering in sleepless sleep, kept alive only in eroded idols, brought from beyond the stars that dimmed aeons ago. Then the Hellgate was opened in 1099, and the beast stirred from its slumber. Awake once more, it found the world overrun with the hated children of Yahweh, and shackled with rules, law, order, and morality. But with the Hellmouth spewing its unholy fumes that spread across the world, it swung the balance of power in favor of the beast. Remnants of its children, though few in number, prowled from their hiding places to enact a great and powerful plan. They were to go forth and multiply, and their new adherents would come from the ranks of the children of God. Finding converts proved far easier than one might think. The beast found that not all humans were well suited to withstand the grinding pressure and deprivation of the Great War. Grief for lost loved ones and unrelenting fear were ever present to most people. Veterans returned from the front crippled in mind and body, haunted by the terrors of warfare. Alcohol and opiates offered only a brief respite to those who sought their aid. Hunger and poverty under the heavy burden of war taxes sapped many a will to live. In their hearts, a great many wished they could forget their troubles altogether and live a life without fear. So when the moon grew fat, the hymns of the feral nymphs could be heard, their siren songs luring many to forbidding forests and desolate mountains where the children of the beast awaited them. None is truly immune to the seductive call of the beast. There is always a seed of doubt in even the most stalwart mind. When the men and women came as sleepwalkers to the idols of the beast, they found themselves surrounded by feral, gleaming eyes in the dark, and sibilant whispers offering them a choice. Unlike Beelzebub's black grail, which takes its victims by force, or the yoke of slavery of the court, the beast wants mortals to willingly renounce their claim of being the image of God and turn their backs on the promise of salvation. And many willingly knelt before the altars of the beast to become supplicants, the lowliest of the followers of the path. Once accepted, there is no turning back. This then is the path of the beast. The unraveling of the cohesion of their bodies and loss of divine inheritance. Freed from the shackles of laws and with morals thrown aside, replaced by howling and killing and reveling in joy, the great gift of the beast to its followers is the bliss of oblivion. All past anguish and shame is lost, replaced by the wild thrill of the hunt. The cost is to be beyond salvation and be both the hunter and the hunted, to wage feral war against order and laws of both men and God. Each supplicant, no matter how high or low, is marked by bestial runes carved on their naked skin with obsidian knives during the revelries of the beast as they are initiated to the path. When the packs of the path gather together, these symbols burn and bleed, reacting to the presence of different runes, bringing forth great and terrible hidden powers within them. A clever pack leader knows how to organize its followers so that they may gain the most suitable dark blessing to be called forth in battle, combining the runes to form words of power. Each fork of the path leads the supplicant to a different end. Most become half-bestial creatures, their will insufficient to take them all the way into full beasthood. They are half-breeds with beasts' heads and claws emerging from their flesh, which they shed as a wolf sheds its coat. They are plagued by the monstrous parasites of the path that fill them with the transformative blood of the beast. They form into great hunting packs, using both human weapons as well as their claws and teeth, as they fall upon those who strive to maintain order. Some advance further on the path through acts of feral frenzy and are able to capture an essence of the beast. A mighty wolf or venomous snake, a great horned goat or another powerful carnivore. Around these great predators, the lesser creatures of the path gather, and in an orgasmic rush of violence, they assault the forces of order. Remote hamlets and isolated villages are often targeted by the packs of the beast. Once the path grows strong enough in its area, it no longer hides. Instead, it goes to war. Its power waxes great during appointed times, and especially when the moon casts its spell over the world. But not all areas where the path hunts are in the wilds. No man's land is teeming with the horrors of the path, who hunt humans for food, for sport, and for the glory of the beast. Packs of the path are led by horned priests, ancient ones who have followed the path for many centuries, devolving ever further from humanity while still retaining an outer form that can fool most observers. They are known for great cunning and twisted wisdom, able to match even the generals of New Antioch and pashas of the Sultanate in planning. Their acumen for the mastery of tactics and strategies has given rise to disturbing rumors that another race, much like man but of deeper and subtler wisdom, once roamed the earth before Adam and Eve were banished from the garden. Priests claim that they have walked the path of the beast beyond the veil where creation began and discovered the wisdom and glory denied to mortals. Mortals who are doomed to grovel and pray to an uncaring God. Once a mortal begins to walk the path of the beast, there is no turning back. The first steps are always the easiest, filling the supplicant with exhilaration and bliss. Reaching the end of the path of ruin is another matter. An ecstatic state of adoration allows supplicants to fall into a deep trance and travel into the unseen world, where lies the object of their thirst and desire. A way to undo the form God's creation has imposed upon mortals. To walk the path of the beast is to walk backwards through the invisible labyrinth of creation itself. The road is neither straight nor narrow, and it runs through the great maze, invisible and ever-changing. Each twist and turn changes the petitioner, costing them part of their humanity and their memories, and changing its form into ever more bestial aspects of itself. Exceedingly few ever reach the end of the path. Almost all the adherents are lost in one of the dead ends from which there is no return. Others lose their purpose and independent will, forgetting what they once were searching for. Forever lost in a shape between the beast and man, they swell the ranks of the packs that haunt the isolated woods and unforgiving mountains. Throughout the ages, people have called such creatures by many names. Skinwalkers, changelings, werewolves, marbendil, and numerous others, in an attempt to define creatures that stand apart from any comprehension. But they are not truly an aspect of the beast. Such privilege is reserved for the chosen few who find their way through the nigh endless, eternally shifting maze. The horned priests teach their followers that at the heart of this labyrinth sleeps Behemoth, first of God's works, a beast that predates the rest of the world. On the skin of the beast are painted Sephirot, the divine emanations, 22 letters of creation. The combinations of these letters and the divine name form the structure of all things, construction of the world and cosmos. Combining these letters, the supplicant will be able to escape all the shackles God has placed on them, so they can remain a part of his great and powerful plan. Here, at the heart of the labyrinth, The clay of creation can be broken down into its parts, remolded by the supplicant as the final prize for the adoration of the beast. The triumphant supplicant will rebuild its being according to its own will, to represent the aspect of the beast that they once decided to follow. It emerges from the labyrinth in the shape of its own choosing, reflecting the inner self as an aspect of the beast, a monstrous thing called the Zygotic Lord. It returns to Earth as a newborn, embryonic and weak, but will then develop according to its own design, rather than according to the divine plan. Its growth into an apocalyptic monstrosity, dictated only by its own will, and the hatred that the beast holds for all humankind. It then travels into the wild places of the world, haunting the deep valleys of the mountains, forgotten grottos or impenetrable forests. The hunting packs of the beast and their mortal followers gather in the vicinity of their lairs to worship it, waiting for it to emerge and lead them into revelries of blood and euphoria. The Zygotic Lord will dwell in its lair for many moons, as its pack brings offerings and choice morsels to consume. It will grow until no dark forest or mountain cave can hide its awful majesty. It then rises and gathers its adherents around it, and the lesser creatures of the path creep and slither from their hiding places. Though possessed with unnatural speed, strength, and enormous size, it is the voice of the Zygotic Lord that the faithful fear the most. It emits howls of adoration, throwing its followers who hear it into an ecstatic state of frenzy. But for those unwilling to accept the path of the beast, it reveals the labyrinth around them in all its awful horror. It takes extraordinary willpower to wrench your mind back into the real world, and most are lost in the labyrinth, dwelling amidst the wonder and glory of the beast forever, even as their bodies lie catatonic in hospices or sanatoriums. Long before the black ships of the heretic fleet appeared on the horizon of Era, the first stages of the plan were put in motion. Zakur, the heretic sea lord who commanded the invasion fleet, had long planned the annexation of the Emerald Isle. A superb general and strategist, as well as a powerful user of Gotic magic, he was the deadliest threat the Irish had ever faced in their strife-laden history. In the years preceding the invasion, the path of the beast started to stir in Era, due to a pact Zakur made with the cult of the moon. The young Irish men and women began to disappear whenever they strayed too far into the woods when the moon was full, only to return home later screaming, their naked bodies carved with beast runes, some giving birth to monstrosities, others escaping to join the hidden covens in the wild. Many others willingly answered the call of the hymn of the beast and went to the wilds of the Emerald Island, turning their backs upon humanity to escape the terrible burden of the Great War. Remote villages were raided by the devolved supplicants of the beast, and crops were burned. Ira found itself isolated from the rest of the faithful nations, as more and more of their merchant vessels were intercepted and plundered. All this sapped the strength of the island nation, and the guard of the shores grew lax as the Irish struggled to contain the servants of the beast. A follower of the great infernal Duke Focalor, Zakur was supremely suited to his role as conqueror, for his lord commanded the winds and the waves. Once he felt the Irish were sufficiently weakened, the heretical sea lord gathered his ships and concentrated them into one mighty fleet, making landfall near Ballyaha Clia. He achieved almost total surprise, with his expeditionary force bringing the mighty heretic artillery on land unhindered. As the Irish gathered their forces to defend their shores, Zaka unleashed the next stratagem of his master plan. With an enormous blood sacrifice of captives, enough Gotic power was unleashed to open the long dormant hell gate of the Lake Polonifrin, bringing the armies of the court to support their heretic invasion forces. Caught between two forces and harried by the horrors of the Path of the Beast raiding their supply columns, the army of Ira was routed and the High King Muradach fell in battle. Zaka took the crown of Ireland from his severed head and claimed the island by the right of conquest. With the field army of Ira gone, the coastal cities fell to the invaders. Bali Aha Clea, Loch Garman, Dún Canorn, Clún Mala, Limnic and Galiv were taken, as well as many other towns and cities. The cathedrals, churches, monasteries, abbeys and shrines of the saints were razed to the ground or converted into temples of blood. Sacrificial altars were erected where holy shrines once stood, and the black knives took the lives of those who dared to rise against the new masters of Era. Heretic priests now taught hell's coercion in the halls, where once the joyous hymns of the holy word echoed. The Irish were reduced into fighting guerrilla warfare in their own lands. With their cities either burned to the ground or in enemy hands, the newly crowned King Niall moved the capital to the inland town of Sil Cheney, where the High Kings of old once held court. The inland city proved easier to defend, as the heretic fleet could not bring its guns to bear, but this only led to more and more of the countryside falling to the invaders. The following decades saw almost all of the country taken by the heretic forces, and a huge number of refugees attempted to escape over the sea to France, Alba, and England. Many were caught by the heretic navy, with yet more sacrifices being chained to red-hot bronze pillars or sold into slavery of the court of the seven-headed serpent. Some others gave up on all their hopes and dreams, turning their backs upon humanity and walking into the wild places to walk the path of the beast, only to return as devolved creatures to prey on those they once called their countrymen. As the war roiled across the Emerald Isle like a storm of death, it was as if a huge snake inexorably swallowed its living prey whole, while most of the world simply watched. With their fleet lost to them in the Battle of the Bloodied Cliffs, England was unable to intervene in the war, despite the obvious danger of Era falling to the infernal powers and giving the heretics an ideal base for launching a full-scale conquest of the island of Britain itself. Only the Crown of France still sent reinforcements to support the Irish. The rest of the faithful coalition offered little more than prayers. However, the Duke of New Antioch sent his own bodyguard to aid the Irish, with a message saying that Era needed them more than even the home of all our hopes. As a young queen, Brigid rose to the throne in 1890, after her father was killed in the front lines by artillery witch Coven bombardment. By this time, it seemed all hope was lost. In most maps drawn in Europa, Era was shown as part of the heretic domains, forever lost to the shadow of hell. Ignoring her advisers, Brigid married Domnall, a great general and strategist despite his low-born origin. Together they made a desperate plan to save the kingdom. As one of her first acts, the queen lifted the ancient ban on Fianna, the hunter warriors of the wild, despite the irritation of her confessor due to the many pagan ways of the Fianna. With the additional troops secured, the royal court called the clans to send what remained of their strength to take on the heretic main forces. The queen then wrote a letter to the Pope, asking for the Bishop of Rome to spare but a single warrior to aid the Irish as a symbolic token of his support. When the Supreme Pontiff granted the wish, Brigid then audaciously requested the services of the paladin Anseis. To the astonishment of the princes of the church, the promise was honored, and the holy warrior was dispatched to aid the beleaguered Irish. Undertaking his sacred quest in utmost secrecy, the paladin stormed the Hellgate alone, taking only his weapons and the banner of Storogram to aid him in the surprise raid. After receiving information that Zakur the Conqueror was aboard his flagship Hymn of Obscenity, a raid by the flying columns of Fianna was sent to cut off the head of the snake. How the Fianna were able to learn the heretic passwords, and how they managed to fool the beast guard of Zakur is unknown. What is known, however, is that against all odds, the Fianna succeeded. The mighty behemoth warship was sunk when its ammunition cache was blown up by a Fianna berserker who carried a barrel of explosives through a hail of bullets. The great heretic conqueror was killed in the explosion that took out several other battleships. Though a huge blow to Hell's forces, this alone would not have changed the course of the war. But from the south came the news that Paladin Anseis had succeeded in his mission. The irreplaceable armor of Anseis had been torn and his eye lost in battle, but the Hellmouth collapsed behind him as he emerged from the inferno, bloodied but victorious. Without their leader and cut off from their allies of the Court of the Seven-Headed Serpent, the heretic forces were thrown into turmoil. This was the moment the Irish had been waiting for. The Queen's consort, Domnall, led the Irish forces in a campaign that swept the invaders into the sea in a series of brilliant battles. Their losses were horrendous. More than three quarters of the Irish forces perished before the heretics were defeated, and only thanks to the Fianna, keeping the path of the beast at bay, they managed to secure enough supplies to keep the army on the field. Not one of the Duke's bodyguards survived the campaign, and to this day, the Irish send their expert skirmishers to aid New Antioch in their memory. All in all, the invasion cost the lives of half of the population of Eire due to fighting, famine, and people fleeing the island. It acts as a stark warning to the faithful on how close they all are to utter ruin. Heretic priests who rise as trench ghosts resume the command of their dead followers in the afterlife, performing a parody. They become the nobility and commanders of the dead, echoing the role they had in life. Such mighty shades of the dead dimly recall the desire to rise in the hierarchy of the heretical order that drove them in life, and their thirst for glory gives them no respite even in death. Their life's ambitions now denied to them, these ghost leaders instead set about creating petty kingdoms and domains which they rule over as undead tyrants, compulsion driving them to pursue the goals of glory and power that are now out of their reach. They create crude makeshift scepters and crowns, striving to fulfill the aspirations that still gnaw at them, granting them no rest. Empty symbols of meaningless titles, they vainly declare themselves to hold. But the most powerful of them become ghost kings, holding shadowy courts in the ruined temples and desecrated basilicas of no man's land, making insane proclamations and setting policies for their followers to enact, even though each day is the same as the one before for the ghosts. There is nothing but coldness, a terrible sense of emptiness, and slow decay into black, sentient dust. Lofty plans of conquest and the expansion of their domains only leads to the same end, a pointless rule over cold, barren land and corpses. Such existence drives the vain ghost kings into deep pits of despair and hatred, driven by a burning jealousy towards all the living. The ghosts envy the mortals who can still hope to attain their ambitions, while the dead are doomed for all eternity. Even the warmth of the flames of hell is denied to them. Only in battle can the undead feel even the tiniest spark of significance. When they sense the presence of the living, the ghosts fall silently but eagerly into rank and await their leader's command to go forth into battle once more. A trench ghost warband may stalk their prey for years, holding fierce grudges against any they fight. This includes other trench ghost warbands, for the ghosts are proud and vain. The mightiest ghost kings and queens, tyrants, duchesses and marquises are venomously jealous of each other, frequently declaring wars and blood feuds upon their rivals, whom they see as usurpers and false kings. Such undead despots often go to war riding tank palanquins, scavenged from armored vehicles and broken tanks abandoned in no man's land. The aristocracy of the trench ghosts are not powered by diesel or petrol. Instead, the vehicles become animated by the souls that serve the Ghost King in eternal slavery. A servant who displeased their master in life may be punished in death by becoming one of the enslaved wraiths pulling the tank palanquin in no man's land. Some of these damned wretches are chained to the tanks with barbed hooks, collars, and shackles, while others are ground to dust and imprisoned in the tank engines, their wails echoing through its structure as the vehicle lurches into motion, draining the spirit of those trapped within. There is no fate more miserable for a trench ghost. Atop the tank palanquin rides the proud Wraith Lord itself, the vehicle acting as both a hideous parody of a throne, as well as granting its rider a great degree of protection and a lofty position to rain down a hail of rusted bullets upon their enemies. Despite the rust and decay eating away at it, shots bounce off of the ghastly tank, as almost no weapon has the power to penetrate their armor. Over the years, tank palanquins become festooned with trophies, captured banners and flags, as well as armaments taken from the enemies of the Ghost King. Their troops bring gold, works of art, and artifacts of old as tributes, which are then crudely attached to the vehicle. The spectral nobles try to fill the gnawing emptiness within by surrounding themselves with testimonies of their past victories. Yet no matter how many relics they tie to their mobile thrones with barbed wire, or how many banners of vanquished companies they fly, ultimately, the Ghost Kings know that they sit on a meaningless throne of nothing. So they trundle onwards, to the next battle, to the next slaughter, to the next conquest, to add to their roll of domains, carefully recorded by ghostly scribes who endlessly drone the lists of their Dreadmaster's victories in an attempt to appease their cold wrath. When the eerie searchlights of the tank palanquins flicker in the mists rolling across no man's land, and as the wailing choir of barbed wire banshees announces the arrival of their lord, the wise turn and run. For once you hear the rumbling of the tank palanquin, and the undead lord's cold eyes have seen you, it will be too late to flee. Even among the forbidding 66 domains ruled by the heretic warlords, Ekron stands apart. It is shunned by both the mortal followers of Hell and the servants of the court. No place on earth mirrors the carnage and corruption of Hell so closely as this putrescent city of Beelzebub, the Lord of the Flies. The King of Gluttony was one of the first three of the most exalted angelic spirits to fall. Since those ancient days, when he was worshipped as Baal of Flies, a great god of the people known as Philistines, Ekron has been his stronghold. where the power of the Prince of Decay is at its most potent. Today, none are welcome here. Even the heretic legions pledged to the sin of gluttony keep their distance. They know full well that even in their fallen state, Beelzebub sees in them a glimpse of his hated father. Were they not created in his image? Are they not a reminder of his ancient ignominy when his mortal followers abandoned him? In the ancient past, Beelzebub coveted the Ark of the Covenant, seeking to claim it for himself. His servants captured the holiest of the relics in his great victory over the servants of God at the Battle of Eben Ezer. Yet though his mortal servants seized the Ark from the Hebrews, they dared not to bring it to this city, for Yahweh punished those who stole the symbol of his covenant. Plague afflicted the people of each town to which it was taken, and the Lord's hand was heavy. He brought devastation upon them and afflicted them with tumors. So terrifying was the Creator's affliction that the people of Ekron abandoned the orders of Beelzebub and voluntarily sent the Ark back to the chosen people. Humiliated and enraged beyond mortal measure, Beelzebub swore never to forget this disgrace. From that day on, he devoted himself to the corruption of all creation, vowing to despoil the world until all that lived would be subject to his will and absolute rule. Beelzebub stalked into his great citadel in the seventh circle of hell. Here he labored for the next 2,000 years to forge the crowning achievement of his dark genius, a plague of his own design. It would not only eclipse those his father sent to punish the Pharaoh, but mar and corrupt all creation. Never again would he trust mankind, so weak and easily bent to the will of the tyrant god. Long he labored, pouring much of his divine essence into his work. When the Black Grail was unleashed upon the world in the black year of 1436, it brought the world to the brink of utter ruin. The newly established Order of the Fly raised the city of Ekron from the rubble, and the power of Beelzebub seeped through from the hell gate of Jerusalem that was. It slithered for many miles, settling upon towers and walls, and streamed through the streets in a torrent of demonic hellflies, scorpions, locusts, and other infernal insects infested with the Black Grail. Ekron stands as the seat of Beelzebub's earthly power, where his worshippers assemble from across the world to offer tribute to the King of Gluttony. Wherever the Black Grail spreads and the Order of the Fly raises its Lord's standard, they seek offerings to bring back to the city. To the missionaries of the Black Grail, it is a realm of beauty and divine vision, a whispered promise of the world to come, and a place their hearts yearn to behold. To everyone else, it is a domain of abject horror, where a fate worse than hellfire awaits. After nearly 600 years under the ravages of the Black Grail, Ekron is a city of overflowing splendor and revolting decay. Entire temples, churches, mosques, pagodas, shrines, and altars from every corner of the world are scattered throughout the city, borne there by the hands of untold millions of Grail thralls. Amidst streets seething with undead corruption stand wonders of art, marble statues, elegant porphyry pillars, frescoes, and icons of gold studded with precious stones. Yet though they are worth the ransom of 1,000 kings, it is not their monetary value that interests Beelzebub. It is thought that the Lord of the Flies can tap into these objects of devotion, feeding on the power of adoration that still lingers in these monuments of faith. Like a parasite swelling upon its host until it is swollen to the point of bursting, he leeches the power of faith until he is so engorged with it that his great wings might once more carry him skyward to storm the gates of heaven. to make the religious objects more palatable and pleasing to their lord and master. The clergy of the fly conducts elaborate rites of desecration. Through complex rituals, they corrupt icons and holy places, transforming them into morsels, offerings to be devoured by his ravenous gluttony for worship and adulation. Yet he will never be sated. Though he seeks to fill the terrible emptiness festering within him, his hunger can never truly be assuaged, no matter how much of creation he consumes. For what the Lord of the Flies hungers for, above all his other unnatural appetites, is the sole right to divine worship, a birthright he feels his father has usurped. In his mind, the natural order is for the parent to die so their offspring may rise in their place. And who more suited to take the throne of God than Beelzebub, the most gifted of his children? Thus it is written in the tablets of Ekron, "Be not afraid, for behold, I bring you tidings of great joy which shall be for all the people, for the Black Grail has come." Hakapolitas are light cavalry troops of Finland, which act as the first line of defense against the heretic menace of the northern Hellgate. Their name is derived from their war cry, Haka Pele, roughly translated as strike at them, and it has echoed across many battlefields since the formation of the units in the 1600s to counter the opening of the northern Hellgate. Motor vehicles are an expensive rarity here, far from the main power centers of the faithful. Instead, the protectors of the north rely on their trusty cold-blooded Finn horses, smaller in size than many of their counterparts, but strong, hardy, and well-suited to the freezing temperatures of the harsh Finnish winter. Hakapelitas are armed with rapid-fire rifles and pistols they like to shoot at close distance, though some are expert marksmen and dismount to act as deadly snipers when they detect the enemy. In melee, they use cavalry swords as well as lances tipped with explosives. Their tactics involve rushing at the enemy and firing a rapid volley with their pistols, then charging in with their swords. If they encounter heavily armored enemies, the explosive lances are brought to bear. The armor worn by both the soldiers and their horses is lighter than that of their counterparts in other faithful nations, reflecting the rarity of the precious orichalcum steel in the far north. Lacking manufacturing plants of their own, Finnish soldiers are experts at using the weapons, munitions, and equipment taken from their fallen enemies. Most faithful armies refuse to even touch such armaments, fearing the corrupting influence of hell. But the warriors of the north can afford no such luxury, and can be seen handling rifles and blades taken as war prizes from fallen heretics. Few roads cross the trackless forest of Finland that stretches for hundreds of miles. The roads themselves act as ideal places to ambush the heretics, and terrain outside the roads is even more dangerous. Within the impenetrable woodlands, deadly swamps and bogs await the unwary during the summer, while during the dark of winter, a deathly pall of snow descends upon the land. The cold brings quick death to any would-be invader who would cross this unforgiving land, unprepared and ill-equipped. The Finnish forces use their knowledge of the lay of the land to even the odds. They are too few in numbers to match their enemies in open battles. During major invasions, the Hakapelitas act as recon and skirmish forces, delaying the enemy as the faithful muster their armies to counter them. In recent years, the death factories of hell have begun to produce more and more tanks and other armored vehicles. The Hakapelitas have adapted their tactics in response, carrying anti-vehicle mines, Molotov cocktails, and other weapons capable of dealing with enemy armor, as well as their traditional weapons, which lacked the power to pierce the metals crafted in the Iron City of Dis. These Finnish border reavers know the importance of their role. The populations of the north are too small, and the border area too vast and inhospitable for permanent defensive lines. Instead, the Hakapelitas must determine when they are facing clever feints or small raider warbands, and when the forces of hell are mustering for major invasions. Many in the past have penetrated deep into faithful lands, with the most recent one driving far into the south when a full-scale invasion by the followers of Ziminiar struck deep into the south in 1908. The invaders were only stopped in the cataclysmic Battle of Vilnius, where the combined forces of the Kalmar Union, Free State of Prussia, Tsardom of Novgorod, Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and the Principality of Kiev stopped them at the very gates of the ancient city. To avoid another disaster from such an invasion, the patrols of the north must keep an eternal vigilance over these forbidding, vast lands. The Hakapelita shown here, Johannes Falk Koskela, is one of them. A veteran warrior who patrols the northern frontier, intercepting small heretic warbands and watching the north for any signs of major invasions, and intercepting enemy infiltrators and raiding parties. Johannes served for 7 years in New Antioch before returning to his northern homeland, hardened by war. Haunted by his experiences, he enlisted with the border forces and joined many others like him, who understand why return to civilian life is near impossible. He is known for his near suicidal bravery in long distance patrols that have taken him ever nearer to the Hellmouth itself. His faithful steed, Hela, shows the terrible signs of corruption that plague all animals that stray too close to the infernal gate. As with many steeds, Hela is festooned with holy symbols, as these are believed to keep evil at bay. The bond between the steed and the rider is often strong, and the Hakapelitas spend much of their meager pay on holy icons and crucifixes, hoping to protect their loyal mounts from the influence of evil, as well as from the dreaded Marbendil of the Path of the Beast, which stalk the forgotten grottos and swamps in the lands that have been claimed by the heretic lords of the north. If you are still listening, thank you. I really hope that you enjoyed this video. I know that Trench Crusade is highly favored in our community, and I promise to do my best and bring you more content consistently. When I started the channel almost a year ago, I never imagined that there would be 25,000 of us gathered here. It would not be possible without you. Before I let you go, please like the video if you enjoyed it, and subscribe to the channel if you'd like to see more content like this. You can also support me directly by purchasing wallpapers from my Ko-fi page, or become a monthly supporter. All relevant links should be in the description. Thanks again, and I wish you a good day or a good night. Thank you.